Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to be back with you after a week-long Southwest road trip with my wife, Kristen. Had a wonderful time, and in fact, later this hour, I'll tell you a little bit about the trip, because it was quite eye-opening for us, what we saw traveling the American Southwest. And I want to hear from you later this hour, if you've already taken an early summer road trip or flown somewhere for a vacation, what you experienced, whether it's in COVID-19 practices that you saw or just sheer numbers of people and what that meant for the places that you visited. I also want to take a moment to thank the hosts who sat in this chair while I was gone last week. Sharon McNary, so appreciate her terrific reporting, and Sharon for 4 days last week hosting Air Talk in my absence. And of course, Kyle Stokes, who started off a week ago today hosting the program as well. Kyle, our outstanding K-12 education reporter, and appreciate both of them making themselves available to do the great job of hosting. We begin with the very latest on COVID-19. Joining us from UC San Francisco Medical Center, Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist. Dr. Chin Hong, a very good Monday morning to you.
Morning, Larry, and welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back. One of the things I wanted to start with you about is what's your perception of how these first 6 days of California's full reopening, how's that struck you, what you've seen?
It's been liberating, I think, for many of us. I think people are cautiously going out to the world. For the most part, it's been really positive. In Northern California, a lot of people are still wearing masks. I was in the grocery yesterday, and I would say 90% of people are still wearing masks indoors, and it probably just supports the fact that people still probably need a little bit more time. It wasn't, people weren't necessarily anxious or anything, but it was just something we've grown accustomed to, and people continue to wear them. Outdoors, I've seen more people without masks on, but I think certainly in the indoor setting, it's pretty much feels similar.
Yeah, and it is a bit of an adjustment. I have to say, on the road trip that we took, because we were in northern Arizona, New Mexico, and southern Colorado, and the practice has varied a bit from region to region. For example, when we're on the Navajo reservation, they still have a full mask-wearing policy because, of course, their population was devastated by COVID-19, and those rules continue for the Navajo Nation. But other places in northern Arizona, for example, we saw almost no mask use.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When you go to countries in Asia, and I remember right after the original SARS epidemic, people were wearing masks for a very long time after, because they've seen their neighbors, their friends, their communities get so devastated that, I think that practice continued for so long. And even when COVID started, those same communities that were hit by the original SARS embraced masks like there was no tomorrow, again, reprising what they had felt like a few years before.
The New York Times had a very interesting article today about doing antibody testing for COVID-19 after people have been fully vaccinated. I just heard anecdotally there are some doctors who are recommending this for their fully vaccinated patients, even if those patients don't have some sort of an immunocompromised medical condition, because we know that in some cases, people whose immune systems were already compromised may not have as robust a response to the vaccinations as people who don't have those conditions. What do you think about people, again, who are not immunocompromised or are not on medication that might suppress immune response, having antibody tests?
I think certainly there has to be a discussion before you get the test, because you have to understand what the test means. First of all, you have to get the right test. I think the other day, for example, somebody texted me saying that their husband had gotten a test on his own outside through Quest or something, and it was negative, and she was really concerned, and it was the wrong test, because if you just get the regular antibody test, which is the original test detected just to see if you've had exposure to COVID before, it's just a different part of the virus. It's called the N protein. And what you really want to assess vaccine efficacy is the spike protein antibodies. So it requires a specific test that not everyone has. The second comment is, what if you're negative and you're not one of those groups? Does it mean that you're truly non-protected? There's some, evidence that at least even before COVID vaccines and previous vaccines, that you have these memory T cells and memory B cells. They are memory cells. So even if you can't detect it in the blood, if you stimulate the patient with the real deal, the antibodies will come out of the woodwork. And so in other words, having a negative test for otherwise healthy patients doesn't mean that you don't have protection. And it may instir, make people feel a little bit anxious.
Well, and is there any way to determine if you're someone who takes a spike protein antibody test and it doesn't show that there was a response? Is there any way then to do a follow-up test to determine whether that sort of protection you're talking about, the more subtle form, is operative?
Yeah, that is a great question. Right now, the commercially available tests for the other kinds of immune response is not really in full use per se. So you're kind of just stuck, for most people, with the regular spike protein antibody test. Sometimes people's immunity increases with time. So if somebody did get a test and was negative and they were worried, if they already got the test, then you can repeat it again in a few weeks to see if anything has changed. But in terms of the hidden immune cells that are not captured by this test, it's mainly in research. There's some commercially available tests now for T cells, but again, we don't know how to interpret that outside of a research setting.
We're talking with infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Chin Hong, professor of medicine at UC San Francisco, joining us from UCSF Medical Center. Dr. Chin Hong, reading this New York Times article, there's a paragraph that stood out to me, and I'll just read it verbatim. But antibody tests can be crucial for people with weak immune systems or those who take certain medications, a broad category encompassing millions of people who are recipients of organ donations, have certain blood cancers, or who take steroids or other drugs that suppress the immune system. Mounting evidence suggests that a significant proportion of these people do not produce a sufficient antibody response after vaccination. So my question is, if the New York Times describing this as millions of people, are these largely the 5% of fully vaccinated people who are going to get COVID-19?
Well, we still don't know if lack of detection of antibodies, even in these immunocompromised individuals, means that they would still get the same full-blown COVID. Some people think they may actually get a milder version, even if they have no detectable antibodies, for many of the reasons I previously discussed. We don't have enough data. So right now, the guidance is for people with suppressed immune systems, they should still be careful. It turns out that those people are generally very careful in life anyway. Say you've received a transplant. Those people navigate the world with caution as their baseline. So I think it wouldn't be anything too much out of the ordinary, but certainly they'd be want to be more careful in terms of visiting communities with higher levels of disease. I think in California right now with these patients, you're still generally under the force field of the general community. But suddenly, if you leave this area, things may get more dicey, particularly with the Delta and other variants circulating.
You know, one of the things I've heard is that some hospitals are offering antibody tests for their staffs. Do you know, is this true? And what would the rationale for that be?
I think it's treading in dangerous territory for the general population because, you know, it wasn't something that we do normally in vaccines. Say you get the flu vaccine, nobody checks your immunity to flu because you're relying on population benefit, not individual benefit for the general population. Of course, immunocompromised patients may be a little bit different in this situation. But again, the presence of a negative test doesn't mean you don't have protection for a normally healthy person. But this may change with guidance. For example, with hepatitis B, when we give hepatitis B vaccines for work and other requirements, we check an antibody status, say you're in healthcare or chickenpox, because you'd want to know that status before someone goes into a risky workplace. And in those settings, and this is where I think things will evolve with COVID, when you have a low titer or a low number or an absent number, you get another series. And I think things are early right now, but that's where things may be headed. There was a recent study last week, actually, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, looking at transplant patients who it was a convenience sample, but they got a third shot of the vaccine, just, you know, not systematically in a study, just people just did it on their own. And 30% of the non-responders did get a response after a while. And we see that in hepatitis B vaccines as well.
So does this argue that for people who are immunocompromised, for example, to get a third dose of vaccine?
Well, I think people are mixed about it because we don't have robust data yet, but I think that's probably where things will be headed. Just looking at the playbook of other vaccines where immunocompromised individuals don't have as full a response. But I think there's still many questions left. You know, what's the timing of this? Could you have waited and would they have just taken a while to get those antibodies compared to the general population? Could you mix and match? The answer probably is yes. You know, how many times do you have to try again after the third time, the third shot? These are all questions that I think people are still grappling with. And not all transplant patients or immunocompromised patients are the same. It's kind of like a volume or a rheostat or a light dimmer switch. There are people who are very, very immunocompromised. Say you've just gotten a transplant within 3 months or so, and people who are less so. So I think, you know, all of these are variables that I think we're grappling with in, you know, vaccine 2.0.
Stephanie in Huntington Beach, you're on with UCSF's Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a kidney transplant, and I took the strike test, and I came out with this number of antibodies. But I can't find any information about, is that adequate? Is that like what normal people have? And it seems to me, don't give me the test if you don't give me a parameter as to tell me whether it's yes or no. So where would I find that information, or do we even have that information?
That's a great question from Stephanie. And that's the reason why I think these tests are fraught with a little bit of danger. And that's because we don't really have national guidelines or guidance outside of a study. You know, right now, we don't really have a standard for what is very low or what is normal in terms of a range. People have guesses, but again, it's hard to implement this in a clinical care setting outside of a study. But I would say guidance will probably be coming out, you know, soon in the next few months.
Stephanie, do you recall what your level of antibody response was to the spike protein test?
1,300.
So, Dr. Chin Hong, do you know what that means?
It sounds pretty good to me, 1,300. And, you know, there are people who are much lower than that in the say the hundreds or the tens, and that's what's definitely called a low titer when you looked at that particular study that I quoted. So 1300 does sound in a good range. And, you know, optimistically speaking, the fact that it was detected at all is a good sign for Stephanie.
All right. And Stephanie, I understand your sister also had a kidney transplant and she had a spike protein test?
Yep. And she had zero. There was nothing detectable. So now we have to wonder, do we have to protect her more? What should she do as a follow-up? I'm not sure I understand why they give the test if they don't have any information to provide you after you have the test results.
Yeah, Stephanie, it makes so much sense, because if you would say to your sister, for example, well, you should try having a third injection, or if it was J&J second, vaccination to see if you get a response from that. But if there's no follow-up, then Dr. Chin Hong?
Yes, exactly. And that's the reason, and this is a true theme for much of medicine. If you don't have parameters or guidance around getting a test result, then the test may invoke much more anxiety and fear and questioning than if you didn't get the test, in a sense. And it sounds weird to say that, you have a technology for a test, but if you don't know what to do based on the results of the test, you might as well not have had the test.
I guess, one sort of simplistic takeaway would be that Stephanie can feel safer as she goes out into the world than her sister would perhaps feel. But then that's not much comfort for her sister either as she does that. But Stephanie's call really points out what you were saying immediately preceding it, is that the response for people who are immunocompromised is widely variable.
It is variable. And it's about, I think, in transplant recipients, on average, around 50% of detectable antibodies. In cancer patients, it's a little bit higher, much higher, actually, because the cancer patients have a general spectrum that's much broader than transplant patients. So for solid organ tumors, for example, if you had a lymphoma or leukemia, but say a kidney cancer or lung cancer, those responses are generally in the 90s.
We'll continue with Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Stephanie, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Dr. Chin Hong at UC San Francisco Medical Center. He's professor of medicine at UCSF and infectious disease specialist. For 16 months plus, he has been one of our go-to medical authorities as we talk about COVID-19 vaccination today, spending considerable time talking about antibody testing and particularly the test to determine what the reaction from a vaccine was when it comes to the spike protein of COVID-19. We'll continue our conversation and take your phone calls on this Monday at 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about early summer vacation. School is out, and for many families, that means hitting the road or taking to the skies to go to a vacation destination that perhaps they had planned for 2020 or maybe came together quickly in 2021 after the strong results from vaccination. We'll talk about those experiences with listeners. I want to hear what the crowds were like, what the experience of getting back in the air or on the road was like. I'll share experiences from Kristen and my trip through the American Southwest last week. That's coming up in a few minutes. But right now, Dr. Peter Chin Hong joining us from UC San Francisco Medical Center. Anival writing on the Air Talk page says, my family started going out again. We ate in a restaurant at 100% capacity. I'm still wearing my mask. But here in Orange County, I'm seeing less and less. I want to keep my mask because I want to avoid common colds now. What's recommended to ease the anxiety of catching a cold or flu? I'm seeing that my worriedness is shifting from COVID-19 to viruses in general. Over the weekend, I thought I was coming down with a cold, but I think it was allergies or just a scare. Anival, I'm so glad you raised that, because I think there are a lot of people that are experiencing that. We've been in this heightened state of awareness and caution because of COVID-19 and the high stakes about potentially catching COVID-19. And Dr. Chin Hong, it's kind of natural, I think, in the way that we're wired, as that threat diminishes, that that heightened state perhaps transfers to other health threats.
Exactly. First of all, I must say, just overall, wearing a mask was the only thing that we had control of for much of the year. So I think it was our, you know, it was our way to control the pandemic because so much of it was out of control. So it's understandable that many people feel that way still, particularly in California. And we, again, were hit so recently that those memories are very vivid in our minds. But there are many non-COVID reasons to continue wearing a mask. One includes, colds are definitely back. I know several people who are so bummed out because they hadn't had a cold for a year or more than a year, and now they're getting colds again. And you almost have to apologize to people when you have a cold now. You have to say, oh, it's not COVID, or I got vaccinated, as kind of a disclaimer, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon socially. But certainly, there are many colds that you can prevent by wearing a mask, but you also have to be more careful about surfaces. Some of the cold viruses, there are more than 200 of them, are transmitted by touching. So the mask itself probably prevents you from touching your nose and mouth from fomites, which is how many colds are spread, in addition to respiratory spread. Allergies, people got a lot fewer symptoms of allergies by wearing masks. I think, one other group that's been interesting is in the under 12 set, the parents of the under 12 set, they, speaking to a few parents, feel in solidarity, want to model for their kids what to do. So those parents, a lot of them continue to wear masks in the same way that, when you tell your kid to wear a helmet while riding a bicycle, you want to wear it too, because, again, you want to model that parenting role. So lots of non-COVID reasons to wear it. But I would say, particularly coming up to flu season in the late fall, winter, we're expecting flu to come back a little bit more with a vengeance this year, that wearing a mask will help you from getting that for sure, and probably prevent you from missing school, missing work, which is a bummer for influenza, apart from, going to the hospital.
Do you have a couple of differences in symptoms with COVID-19 from cold or other respiratory illness that would help people determine, if they're fearful that they might have gotten COVID, even if they're fully vaccinated, versus gotten a cold or flu? How do you tell the difference?
Well, I think they're very, very similar. That's why I think diagnostic testing for COVID is important. And people have the testing rates have dropped precipitously since vaccines, and people haven't been going for as much testing. But there are many of easily available tests now. So, and the free ones, as well as the ones you can buy in Costco and Walgreens and CVS. But the main differences so far between COVID and a regular cold, apart from just, first of all, if you get lung symptoms, that's probably not a regular cold, because the cold just really stays in the upper airways and the nose and the mouth. It doesn't go down. The second thing is the symptom that we've all heard about with COVID, which is the smell and taste alterations. They don't happen normally in that profound way that it happens in COVID with colds. And then there's several other minor things that are probably a little bit more common in COVID, which include fever and systemic symptoms. So your whole body doesn't react as much in a cold as COVID does. So not perfect, but a few guideposts.
And you've got that sense of taste and smell, but I understand that's not universal with COVID patients.
No, it's not. But it's specific, meaning that if you get it,
then you know.
It's more likely to be COVID. But if you don't get it, that doesn't mean you don't have COVID.
All right. Very good. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I have a number of listeners who are asking a kind of similar question. I'll do my best to consolidate them. And they're people who have autoimmune or immune disorders. And so they've held off getting vaccinated because perhaps they've had bad reactions to vaccines they've gotten before, or the technology of the flu vaccine is something that they were warned off of, for example. So what is your advice to people, or is it highly variable and very individualized for immunocompromised people?
Yes. So in general, my advice is to definitely get the COVID vaccine for the following reasons. First of all, we've actually a lot of people with autoimmune disease have already gotten the vaccines. They were included in the trials as well as in the general population. And the reason why that's important is because in trials, even though smaller numbers than the general population, people were followed very, very closely. And I'm probably more worried about lack of efficacy if they were on a powerful biologic for some people rather than safety worries. And in fact, the American College of Rheumatology strongly endorses getting COVID vaccines for people with rheumatologic and other autoimmune diseases, again, attesting to the risk benefit of, you know, preventing something that can cause many, many more problems than that is COVID, than the potential threat of, you know, making your autoimmune disease worse. In fact, there have been anecdotes, not really well studied, that people with symptoms, just like with long COVID, when they got the vaccine, it kind of got better in a sense when after the vaccine. And that's what immunologists call sort of like antigenic distraction. So you distract the immune system by something else introduced, so it tends to attack your body less.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center, Professor of Medicine, UCSF, and Infectious Disease Specialist. Dr. Chin Hong, where do we stand on developing antiviral drugs to combat the symptoms of COVID-19 for those people who get it?
Well, Larry, that's always been my dream from the beginning of the pandemic. That is, could we get something as easy to take and easily prescribed as Tamiflu for influenza and the analog for COVID? And it turns out that, the government is going to invest in that development in the next phase. So it was recently announced that they're going to give $3.2 billion to develop these kinds of outpatient, easy to take drugs for COVID, because COVID isn't going to go away. And they, I think, appropriately invested in vaccines first, but the next phase will be on oral drugs. There have already been a few in development and testing, one by Merck, one by Pfizer, another by a small company, for example. But they're mainly in the realm of teaching an old drug new tricks. They were developed for other viruses. They have some potential activity against COVID, but they will be studied first. And there'll be numerous first in line drugs again for COVID. And you might say, well, you know, what sense does it make if we have vaccines already? Well, it makes sense again, because we won't all get immunity from the vaccines possibly. And then secondly, not everybody will get a vaccine. And third, for the next pandemic, that might be a virus. It probably will be a respiratory virus. We already have some drugs in the pipeline that we can easily implement.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Chris tweets at AirTalk, schools are excluding students for 10 days or requiring a negative COVID-19 test for vomiting and diarrhea alone. Is that still recommended?
It doesn't make any sense to worry that that person with vomiting is at risk for COVID. I mean, there could be other reasons why kids who have vomiting and diarrhea have infectious disease transmissibility risk, but not for COVID. And they include things like, you know, norovirus and rotavirus that could run like wildfire in a school. So it may be that those kids are being excluded for another reason, but to ascribe it to COVID is probably not the most common thing, the GI symptoms with COVID. So that's how I would think about it.
So 10 days would kind of be a long time unless you in fact knew that the student had COVID?
Yeah, so typically for diarrheal virus, like rotavirus or norovirus or what have you, once the symptoms have resolved, it's okay for that student to re-enter the congregate setting as in schools. 10 days is a bit much, and certainly COVID doesn't usually cause these symptoms.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong joining us on Air Talk. Kevin in Koreatown says, for people who choose not to get vaccinated and go back to the office, shouldn't the responsibility be on those people who didn't get vaxxed to have to wear a mask, not everyone else who is vaccinated?
Yes, I mean, I think it is individual and personal responsibility. But I think where Kyle Osher is going to is, if I mean, certainly if you can keep the people who have no vaccines, away from the people, mainly to protect them, then, you know, that would be the best setting. But again, if you have one, say you have 90%, if say your office has herd immunity, essentially, which is like 80 or 90% of people vaccinated, it probably doesn't make sense to penalize the entire office if one or two people are in fact not vaccinated, but everybody else is.
I have to say, it was so strange to come back to work today and to wear my mask out in the hallways and inside the building here at work, because for the past week while I've been on vacation, there's so little mask. I hardly wore my mask over the course of that week. So then coming back to work today, it was definitely a bit of an adjustment going back to it, because we've kept the very same rules here in our Moan Broadcast Center. Only people who were alone by themselves in a studio or editing bay or something like that can be unmasked. Otherwise, anybody who's surrounded by other people needs to be masked in our workplace. Dr. Peter Chin Hong joining us. Final question for you. It has to do with the Delta variant. That was the one that was first detected in India. We hear that is growing in its percentage of representation of COVID cases here in the United States. Should we be concerned about that one gaining strength versus other strains?
Yes, we should be very concerned, particularly in states where they haven't had very high vaccination rates. So, you know, you're thinking Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, all of those states in the less than 50 group. The Delta variant is not very forgiving at all. It's the bulldog of viruses. It's the Mike Tyson of viruses. It comes in, it bites, and it doesn't let go. And it's overtaken the landscape of the UK. And of course, we look at the UK and Europe as a bellwether for what's coming to the US so many times in COVID. It's now more than 60% of all cases, more than 90% of new cases in the UK, and increasing in the US every week, now more than 10% of cases. So it is going to come. I think we have to be careful. We have to look at destinations we visit, like the weather report, within the US.
But the vaccines that we have currently do appear to be providing significant protection against Delta?
They do, but you need to get full dosing. So there are actually a few million Americans who haven't gotten, or at least hundreds of thousands, who haven't gotten the second dose. So those people should definitely go out and get it. Even if you've not gotten if you got the first dose like a while ago, the second dose, anytime you get it, will give you a little bit more security that you'll be protected.
All right. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, such a pleasure. Great to talk with you again. We'll speak with you again soon.
Looking forward to it, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you, infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Chin Hong, professor of medicine, UC San Francisco Medical Center, who joins us weekly on Air Talk. to share his expertise on COVID-19, on vaccination, on antibody testing, what we're learning about different variants and vaccine effectiveness against them. Coming up, I want to hear from you if you've already taken even a short vacation here in the spring or early summer. What did you experience in your travels? If they're places you've been before, how different were they from when previous visits? As I mentioned at the top of the program, my wife Kristen and I took a week-long road trip through the Southwest. That's a trip we've done many times, and it was different. It was an eye-opening trip. I'll tell you about my trip, but I want to hear about yours. So please call right now, 866-893-KPCC. Where did you go? What did you see? What COVID protocols are in place or not? How many people are visiting? How has the experience changed? 866-893-5722. Back in 90 seconds.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.